This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. Welcome back to it. We are doing part two of Dan's beer library. If you listened last week, then you know we went through a few different beers from Dan's library. We went through Vintage 2019. We went through Very Sour Blackberry, and we went through the 25th anniversary, which was a take on a Belgian quad. This week, we're going to be doing much the same thing. And the thing about when you have a very, very long career in beer, you end up with a very, very large beer library. So we just couldn't fit them all into one episode. How are you feeling today, Dan?
Doing all right. Ready to drink more beer.
You know, I'm sort of always ready to drink more beer too. And if you listen to last week's episode, we did mention that we would be sort of packaging these beers and putting them in the Beer Depot for sort of a silent auction type thing. And since we do sort of record a little bit in advance, that information and those details have already come out or are still a little bit forthcoming. So we don't know quite yet, just because of the timeline on how we record. But if you follow us on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram, I'm sure that is where that information will be. So what are we starting with here today, Dan?
I guess we're going to start with our, I opened our creek.
Works for me.
Okay.
So can you tell us a little bit about a creek beer?
Well, Creek would be Dutch or Flemish for cherry. Cherry beer is a sour blonde ale in the lambic style with fermented and aged and then dosed with a heavy dose of cherries. Mm-hmm. We used one metric ton of cherries in 50 hectoliters 50 hectoliters is times 25 gallons is whatever that comes out to be. So that's pretty much kind of the rule of thumb of how much fruit is normally added to these types of beers. In our Belgian red, we use Montmorency cherries.
Yeah.
And that's normally what you find in Door County. But Deb and I went up and Katie went up to a orchard in Door County, Shatner, and they had Balaton. Cherries, which is a cherry originally from Eastern Europe. And so it was a different character. And we thought, you know, that'd be really cool. Let's make a dry creek, a dry cherry beer, and see how it turns out. And a Belgian red is the base for that is a sour brown ale.
Yeah.
And Montmorency cherries. So this is a sour blonde beer with Balaton cherries. And it is like we talked about in the last episode, it is a blend of sour blonde ale beer that was put into an oak tank with fresh Balaton cherries that with their pits, just fresh cherries that were harvested, brought to the brewery. We gently crushed them. It was kind of a lot of work because we kind of like had to use like a 2x4 and gently just kind of break the skin and throw them through the manway into the tank. And then we pumped the beer in and let it sit for some months. None of these beers are filtered. We don't have a filter in our wild fruit cave. So it's just simply racked off the sediment. Then it's re-fermented in the bottle. This particular beer, base beer, was brewed in 2016, and the fruit was added in a year later in 2017, and then it was bottled the fruit was added in August of 2017, and it was bottled in June of 2018. So with the addition of the fruit, the alcohol went up to about 7.6%, and the original gravity comes in about 17.2. So it's kind of a red purplish color.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah.
It smells like cherry pie, doesn't it?
That is, yeah. Your description of cherry pie, like that is like one of like the best tart cherry pie you could kind of wish for. And You know, sort of with the maltiness on the back, like the tart is there, the sweet is there, but the maltiness on the back end of that really sort of brings it home. And that was exactly apt. And when you said cherry pie, that's absolutely wonderful.
It's certainly different than the Montmorency cherries. Mm-hmm. It's not as tart as the Montmorency cherries, although yeah. This is a dry beer, unlike Belgian Red, which has some body to it. This is completely dry, but again, the fruit has some unfermentable sugars that remain in the beer that give it some mouthfeel and body. So it's not completely, it doesn't give the illusion of complete dryness.
And as we were talking about last week, these beers end up becoming blends of old and new beer, and then the fruited variety are then aged on that fruit. So you said the oldest beer in this bottle in that blend you said was from 2016?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow, so essentially this is another beer that's, you know, taking a very long journey. This is like an 8-year beer, and then it was released in 2019, so this has been in the bottle for 4 years already now.
Yeah. That's right.
And just like we were talking about last time, what's really striking to me about how special something can be when you sort of save it and then come back to it later is because I was around for when this beer came out, and it's so still so bright and still so yeah. so fresh. And yeah, I absolutely love your work in fruited sours. What is sort of your big takeaway from this now 4 years on?
It is it's not as bright as the very sour blackberry was. Mm-hmm. It's showing a little bit of malty oxidation, but that's very pleasant because it gives it almost, and it's higher in alcohol. It's a bigger beer. So I think the combination of the alcohol and the little bit of kind of malty oxidation give it a character of like Kirsch, like a distilled spirit.
Yeah, no, I'm getting that. And it's funny, I just can't get this little image out of my head now that you said it, but you know, when you go up to Door County and there's just all these cherry pie stands and yeah. everywhere has a cherry pie, and it always has this very like distinct, almost like the Door County cherry pie is a different kind of cherry pie than you'll get just about anywhere else. And as I'm drinking this, I'm just like, I'm sitting on the upper deck at a restaurant that I think is no longer exists there called The Cookery, and eating their cherry pie, which I always considered the best cherry pie yeah. in Door County. And this is taking me right back there, which is like, it's a special thing that beer and food can do for people.
Yeah, that's right. You know, they say that your memory is close to the receptors in your brain for taste. So mm-hmm. taste and memory are close. So when you taste something or smell something, it can elicit a strong memories. That's for sure. And this does have a nice, really pleasant cooked cherry flavor.
It really does. And I've had other creeks before, and other creeks from other parts of the world. And sometimes the tartness is really turned up because that's that is a characteristic of a cherry. But this seems a little bit more in balance. Can you take us a little bit back to 2016 when you were blending and first starting to think about this as an R&D release?
Well, when I thought about this beer, I wanted to make a creek beer, a traditional lambic style creek beer. And I didn't want to use Montmorency because we're iconically known for that in Belgian Red.
Yeah, you had to make a sort of distinction there.
Yeah, exactly. And so this Balaton cherry is not as tart as that, and it has more of a, to me, a pie type of a flavor. Mm-hmm. So when we went to this orchard up in Door County to Shatner's, it was a family-owned orchard, and they were very kind to us. We told them what we were up to, and they kind of scratched their head and looked at us like we were crazy, which is a common experience for me and Deb. But we walked around the orchards and we tasted the cherries. And once they got an understanding of what we were doing, they were, of course, as a farmer selling cherries, sure, why not? So when the harvest came in, they came down and we went to work. It was basically just an experiment to see. It was my first experience with Balaton cherries to find out how they would manifest themselves in a beer.
That's very interesting. You know, to hear you sort of talk about it in that way. You know, my first question that popped into my head was, you know, going up to sort of a smaller, and I'm not sure how big the Shatner farm is up in Door County, but do you find when you sort of show up and you're saying like, I'm going to make this beer and I would like to use your cherries and these are the kind of cherries I would like for the flavor profile that, you know, you're sort of, I mean, they are trying to sell you your product, but are you sort of like well-received in that, oh, well, Dan's here and he wants to use our cherries. We now got to figure this out. Or how does that usually go?
Somewhere in the middle. I started with a phone call.
Okay.
And, because I called around to find out who's growing, Balaton cherries. Mm-hmm. And so these guys got recommended. And so they're a small family farm. So it's not like they have somebody sitting in an office, a receptionist who's trained on, you know, taking phone calls.
There's no intake person.
You just call their home and, whoever answers the phone, you know, is like, yeah, hello.
Yeah.
And, hi, my name's Dan Carey. I'm blah, blah, blah. And you know, probably something happened like, dad's out in the field. Let me take a message for you. Mm-hmm. He's out working and, then usually in the normal experience is at about 6:30 or 7 the next morning or next week. You never know with farmers. They kind of are busy and do things at their own pace. You get a phone call, usually, like I said, early in the morning before they go out in the field, told him what we were up to. And he said, sure, why not? You know, basically they all always ask, how much are you willing to pay? And how am I going to get it to you? And those sorts of things. And so Deb and I and Katie went up there in the summer for harvest and met with them. They had a fruit stand where they were selling fruit. And so they were busy. And so they were kind of mildly annoyed that, you know, we showed up in the middle of the day when there's, you know, a line of Chicago cars there buying cherries.
Yeah, the business must continue.
Yeah, exactly. But we wandered around and decided that, yeah, this is a go. Let's do it. So then we just kind of communicated by emails to agree on a price and when we could pick it up. And we arranged for shipping. We used, I think, our own truck. Maybe our wholesaler up in Door County hauled it back for us. And then we just had a schedule blending the beer. It was a kind of casual on one hand.
And then my other question with this beer, and you brought up Belgian Red before, and we've talked about this before when we talked about Grand Cru. Is there ever like you know, a thought in your head when you go to do another cherry beer of like, oh, I'm already known for this one iconic cherry beer. Is there any like trepidation at all? Or are you just sort of like, I have my artistic vision and of course I'm going to use cherries in something else exclusively.
Yeah. It's more, the former, my artistic desires or impulses do not trump the ability to sell the beer. Deb is fond of saying is if you don't have a market for your beer, you're just a glorified home brewer.
Yeah.
And if I have 5 gallons, no problem. But if I have, 50 hectoliters, it's a bit of an issue.
Yeah.
So no, it has to be unique. It has to be, the intent is that it stands on its own, that it's individualistic and that Deb does the marketing and sales and it cannot cannibalize the sale of an existing beer because that's just kind of illogical.
Yeah. There wouldn't be much of a point there.
Yeah, exactly. So we try to make something that's unique. And again, the R&D program is to learn and do fun things. The creative process, Deb is very, very kind and generous to allow us, the brewing team, to do crazy fun things, but it has to pay its way.
Yeah. It's got to make sense in black and white eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, black and red. Yeah,
black and red. I'm sorry. You can tell I'm not the business, not the business person.
Hopefully, black and not red. But yes,
yeah, exactly. So that was Creek, which was from the R&D series, and that was released in you said 2019.
It would have been released in 2018. It was packaged in August after the harvest of 2017. So we would have released it in 2018.
So that is a beer that's already about 5 years old, and it is. It is drinking absolutely amazing. What do you think we should crack open next there, Dan?
Well, I have our 2019 Flander Sour.
I am very excited about this for the reason that I am a huge, huge, huge fan of sour brown beers, and in particular, your sour brown beers. And the ones you come out with in Thumbprint every now and again, to me, are some of my, you know, my favorite beers produced in Wisconsin. So I'm very excited to see how this one's aged.
Yeah, thanks. We have brewed lots of different permeations on a sour brown ale. It's basically a Flemish style of beer. And I also love the style of beer. There was a beer back in the 80s. It still exists, but in the 80s was it's when it was, to me, really, really special, called Golden Bond from Leafman's Brewery. And then, of course, Rodenbach was another one. And the great beer expert and writer, Michael Jackson, not the singer, but the writer, had kind of, human nature being what it is, and he being a reporter, he kind of tried to break beer into categories. And in Belgium, their beer doesn't really lend itself to categorization, because Belgians are not, they don't like to brew, to rule. They like to go their own way. So there's considered brown sour beers and red sour beers, but really they're kind of commingled and overlapping, sort of like porters and stouts.
Yeah.
So I don't really know if that whole categorization really matters. They're all similar in that they're either red or dark, almost to the point of being black. They're malty, they're sweet, and they have a little bit of sourness, and sometimes a lactic sourness, and sometimes they have even a little mini bit of acetic character. And sometimes they go well with a little bit of fruit, a little bit of cherry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was inspired by the Golden Bond beer of Leafman's and Rodenbach beers. So Enigma, which we make from time to time, was inspired by a cherry beer that was made by Rodenbach. I think it was called Alexander. And this beer kind of falls somewhere in the middle of that. It's called Flander Sour. It's... when we taste it, it's almost a dark brown.
Yeah,
it's red or dark brown, almost leaning towards black. And it's been in the bottle 4 years now. It is bottle fermented, so we'll see how it's holding up.
Yeah. Oh wow, it's funny. It's quick. Like it starts quick, right? And
yeah.
You swallow it and it almost like it wants to disappear, but then it just, the subtle sourness, that malt sort of backbone of it just holds onto your palate. And then the flavor sort of really comes on almost afterwards. Like as you're thinking about, well, what did I just drink? It's like, here's what you just drank.
Yeah. You want a well-made beer should be a journey from the aroma through the initial taste, through the crescendo of the main body, and then the aftertaste. And generally, a good beer should have a clipped aftertaste. You want an aftertaste. You want to know that you drank something, but then you don't want it to linger. So in this beer, the aroma is there's certainly a hint of acetic acid.
A little bit.
So it has a little bit of a malt vinegar character, but it's not offensively high.
No.
And then there comes a malty sweetness, which I think is really important to this, to old Bruins or sour browns or red ales. That's very important. And then at the end, there's almost, I mean, this beer is dry. It's bottle fermented, but there's, I almost like I taste sugar. I can, a sensation.
Yeah.
But there's no sugar in this beer. It's completely fermented out.
Yeah, unlike it's Belgian just, quad, there's no...
Yeah, there's no residual.
Yeah.
There's no residual extract. It's a dry beer, but it has the illusion of some sweetness, which is a good way to be left. Yeah. You know, you got the vinegar, and then you have the malt, and then you have aftertaste of sweetness, and then it's gone. And you think, oh, I have another sip.
Yeah. And well, the thing that's like just striking me as so special about going through this and what we're doing here with it is, you know, when things take on an aspect of time, they almost take on an aspect of importance as well, right? Because it's something that was saved and something that was sort of held back. And you had mentioned a little bit before that, you know, there are some beers you'll save and you'll look back on and you'll say, well, I don't think age has done this one particularly well. And that's part of the experiment, right? So to you, what makes like, you know, a good beer that has been aged?
Well, I guess I like analogies. You could imagine that beer is like people. Some people age better than others. And beer has a peak of quality, whatever that might be. So if you're making a beer like Totally Naked or Cabin Fever, it's probably best when it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month into the bottle. That's the peak of flavor, the brightness, the hoppiness, the crispness is in perfect harmony. And then oxidation, the chemical reactions of oxidation start to take hold, just like it did with us. Mm-hmm. And over time, it slowly diminishes. These beers that we're tasting are either reaching their peak now,
yeah,
or they're holding their peak for an extended period of time, because as brewers, when we brew beers, we try to make a beer that has good shelf stability. So sometimes craft brewers will say things like, look, we know that our beer doesn't have a good shelf life, so drink it now, keep it refrigerated and drink it now. And that's great mm-hmm. if you have a pub and you're selling the beer out of your pub. But if you're selling it in a market, we only sell in Wisconsin, but if you're selling your beer all over the country, it's out of your hands. So
yeah,
you have to brew a beer for shelf stability. And there's certain things that you could do as a brewer, you know, keeping iron low, which is a oxidant, keeping oxygen low, which is an oxidant. And there are many, many tricks that you can do through the brewing process to make sure that your beer will, as best as possible, weather the storm that it's going to face through its life. But some beers are better at resisting than others. And as I said in the previous podcast, alcoholic, strong alcohol, dark beers, black mm-hmm. beers, and sour beers, beers with Brettanomyces in them have a tendency to hold up amazingly well. So some beers just are better at lasting. And if they're of those types of characters, they become more harmonious and more marriaged as they age, just like port. Mm-hmm. So for example, a Pinot Grigio from Italy, maybe you might want to drink that fresh. But Porto, you mm-hmm. might taste great for decades.
And this beer in particular is certainly holding up. As I keep sipping it, it's like I'm listening to you and I'm like just kind of drawn to keep drinking this beer. Because as I said, this is a style I just absolutely love that I think you execute, you know, probably as good as anybody doing it on the planet now.
Thanks.
And this is the Flanders Sour from 2019. And I know with this bottle, this was a thumbprint beer, which I think is a special thing.
It was not an R&D beer. It's in a 12 ounce, with the Chevron neck label.
And it's something I was having a conversation about with some of the salespeople, and these sort of tiers of the beers you do and the different price points on them, I think make you guys sort of unique because, you know, this would be a special release beer for a lot of breweries, but for you guys, you know, you can put this in four packs and get it out to market at that kind of scale, I think is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Sometimes we might take a hit on profitability just because it seemed like the right thing to do. Like Gyrator was an example of that. Mm-hmm. We put that in six packs, although that certainly could have been in a thumbprint because of the cost in making that beer and the time to age it. We certainly could have legitimately put it in a four pack at a higher price point, but, you know, we have a relationship with our customers and this is a long-term relationship and we want to build on it. We'll do the right thing.
It's good to do something nice.
Well, it's karma.
Yeah. Well, I think this beer is holding up just absolutely amazing. And drinking these aged beers has been just a heck of an experience. And I think we're going to have one more we can go through here today, too.
Sure. What,
and this is one I'm also very excited about because I absolutely loved it when it came out. And I'm really looking forward to talking about it sort of in depth because I wouldn't go as far as to say I think it was sort of misunderstood because I think you did a really good job explaining what this beer was. But I think it was one of those ones that was, you know, as we discussed Sour Porter a while back, one of those ones that was just, it's just sort of so different from what was out there at the time that I don't think it was understood in the way you might've liked it to be.
Well, certainly it's an esoteric beer. It's it was a collaborative brew with a Swedish, with a brewery in the island of Gotland. It's called, the style is called a Gotland's Dricka, which is a Swedish for a drink from the island of Gotland. Mm-hmm. Gotland is a small Swedish island in the smack in the middle of the Baltic Sea. And there's a brewery, the Visby Brewery. Mm-hmm. And they're a very large brewery in Sweden, big brewery, big drinks company. And they have a small craft brewery in Gotland because Gotland is a tourist island. It's very pretty. It's the town of Visby. It's beautiful. It's definitely worth, if you go to Sweden, spending time in Stockholm is like way cool. It's such a beautiful city.
Yeah.
The island of Gotland is worth going to. But what had happened was there was a guy from the American Chamber of Commerce in Sweden, which is a group that facilitates business between America and Sweden. And the guy that ran it, Randy Gosta, was from Belleville, Wisconsin. And so he called me up one day and said, "Hey, I'd like you to do a collaborative brew with this Visby Brewery in Gotland. Is that something you'd want to do?" And I'm like, "Hell yeah, I've never been to Sweden. Let's do it." And yeah. So I started to work with the brewers by email and talking about what beer to make. And so this would have been in 2017. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were talking about, well, we want to make a pale ale or IPA or blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was all exciting and interesting. And so I started doing some research on this island of Gotland. And I saw that there was this kind of esoteric and interesting beer called Gotland's Dricka. And in fact, I watched a YouTube video of the brewing of this beer from 1963. It is a beer that is iconically Gotlandic. It's a beer that's really only made in the home. And it's a home brew and very traditional beer. And if you go to YouTube and you go to, I think if you Google something like 1963 Visby Brewerie, so Visby is V-I-S-B-Y, and Brewerie means brewery, B-R-Y-G-G-E-R-I. So 1963 Visby Brewerie, you could probably find a video of the making of this beer at home. So it's traditionally not a commercial beer. So it's usually done by the woman of the house, and she will make malt, oftentimes barley malt, sometimes rye malt, and it's smoked malt to dry it. It in like Finnish sati, has juniper boughs in it for filtration. And this video from 1963 is really funny because the I believe, if memory serves, the old husband, he kind of delivers the raw materials and drops it off for the wife, and the wife. So the whole episode is the wife making this beer, and she's going through all of this effort. And, you know, making beer is a lot of work. And then at the end, I think if memory serves, the husband and the son are sitting at the kitchen table drinking the beer, and she's working in the kitchen. And so it is sort of kind of grown worthy, but that's how it was in 1963, unfortunately. But in any event, it's a very cool idea of what this beer was. So I watched this video and I said, "Oh man, I don't want to make a pale ale. Let's make a Gotland's Dricka." So I called the brewmaster and I said, "Hey, why aren't we doing this beer?" And he groans and he said, the powers that be told me that you wouldn't want to do that, so I never brought it up. But thank God that you brought it up, because my grandmother used to make that beer at home. So let's do it.
Yeah,
so,
sort of like, this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah, but he didn't want to say anything. You know, it's funny because we Americans, were, you know, we're loud and abrasive and bust through and say what we want to say, but he was a little bit reserved and he didn't want to push an agenda. And, so we got together and, we made this beer. It's made with, Viking malt from Scandinavia, from the company name is Viking. It's made with smoked birch smoked malt from Viking Malting, as well as cherrywood smoked malt from Breese. There's a little bit of Weyermann, Cara Rye and Cara Roma and Melanoidin malt. So it's a big beer. It's a little over 7% alcohol after bottle fermentation. The original gravity of 18.5 IBUs are like 45. And we actually, when Joachim Inkvist, who's the brewmaster at this brewery, came to New Glarus, we went and we picked juniper berries around the brewery. And then one of our people in the sensory lab, she says she still smells juniper. I don't think she ever got it out of her nose. She made a steep of juniper berries. We actually put juniper boughs in the mash tun in the traditional way, but we also she also made a steep of juniper berries because we didn't know how much to add.
Yeah,
we didn't
want to screw it up. And it's a big flavor. And
yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Juniper, you don't want to overdo it.
No, it a little goes a long way. A little if bit you've ever drank gin, you know.
Yeah, that's right. So, so she took all these berries and she crushed them and she steeped them in water and then she distilled them to get off the essence. And then we put that into the beer and tasted it, decided how much we were going to add. Because I was worried that if we dry hopped with junipers, we would overdo it because people really warned us, please don't do it because it's going to end up tasting like soap or whatever.
Yeah.
So we made this beer. It was smoky and juniper, rich and malty. And yeah, it was, was not a big hit when we came out, but I thought it was pretty cool. There's other people in the United States that have made Gotlandic beers, and we didn't make a lot of it. We made like 30 barrels, and it seemed to kind of pass under the radar. Sometimes I brew beers, and then nobody notices, but then like 20 years later, all of a sudden, everybody, some homebrew magazine will come up with Gotlandic beers, the new cool thing, and everybody will be making it, and I'll be like, I won't say anything, but in my mind, I'm like, dude, I already did that.
I remember 2018 too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But that's another story. That's me whining. But in any event, I'll open the bottle and we'll taste it because now it's almost 5 years old.
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons I absolutely love talking to you and love talking to you when you get really excited about a beer you've made because when we're talking about hops, you'll just drop these little senses like, oh, you know, I was reading a hop forecast magazine from 1939 the other night, or, you know, I started doing some research and then, you know, the little island of Gotland and, you know, I have to imagine not everybody is doing that level of just research. And I have to imagine it comes from just your deep, deep curiosity on this subject.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's 100% true. This collaborative brew was a reciprocal. So I went to their brewery and we made an American style pale ale and it was released. They have a 4th of July party because, you know, midsummer in the middle of the Baltic Sea is a special time because it's like sun stays out forever.
Yeah.
And so they have a American Swedish day on July 4th. And so we did a 4th of July pale ale that was at their big 4th of July celebration, which was also kind of cool to do.
Yeah.
So Gotland is, Stockholm is, it's a crazy, beautiful country. I tell you a quick story that, the brewery, the Visby Brewery, was owned by a large brewery that was like 3 hours away from Stockholm, and I wanted to go visit their big brewery, multi-million barrel brewery, but it's like in the middle of nowhere. So I had to take a train, like a 2.5 hour train ride, and there was a half an hour connection in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I got on the train in Stockholm, and there the train sits, and it's supposed to leave at, you know, X hour, and 10 minutes go by, 20 minutes go by, and then all of a sudden someone comes on the radio and starts, or on the intercom and starts saying something, and but of course I don't fortunately speak Swedish, and everybody starts to get up off the train, and unfortunately everybody in Sweden speaks English, and I ask what's going on. Oh, the train, you know, the train got canceled, but there's another one across the track, so mm-hmm. get on that train. And so I got on that train, but by then I was going to miss my connection. So when the ticket agent or the ticket person came by to check my ticket, I asked her, I said, please, can you help me? Because I'm going to get stuck in this netherworld of Sweden, because Sweden is basically, it's just all forests. Yeah. You know?
I mean, I'm going to get lost in the woods here.
Exactly. Because the train just, it's just all woods. And every once in a while there'll be a break and there'll be a small farm, mm-hmm. but it's all forest. And I thought, you know, I'm going to get dropped in the middle of nowhere and not be able to find my way home. And she said, oh, no problem. Well, you missed your train. We'll get you a taxi. And I said, it's like an hour and a half. And she said, no problem. I said, I don't have enough money to pay for a taxi. She said, no problem. We'll pay for it. I said, what? And she said, yeah, it was our mistake by law. If you miss your connection, we have to make it right. So you go outside of the train station and there'll be a man holding your name on a sign, taxi driver, you get in the taxi and he'll drive you to this town. And I said, okay, cool. So I get out and lo and behold, there's this guy. He's like Eritrean guy standing there with a sign. Hello, hello. Yes, come with me. And I said to him, he said, where do you need to go? And I told him the brewery name. He goes, oh, I know this town. I go there every day. He said, I drive. There's a young woman that has special needs, goes to a special school. I drive her every morning, hour and a half to this town. And then I pick her up and I bring her home every day. I said, oh my God. I said, who pays for that? The government. And I said, just to take care of this young person with special needs. Yep. She goes to a special school. I drive her every day. And so we're driving, a very, very pleasant man. And we're halfway there. And he says, are you hungry? I said, yeah, I guess I'm hungry. He goes, I buy you lunch. So we stop at a roadside cafe. Yeah. And we go in and he buys me lunch. And he drops me off at the brewery. And I thought, man, this is a great country where you have someone from Eritrea who's a taxi driver, who's the kindest, gentlest man you've ever met. And the tax money is keeping everybody at peace. It's a very peaceful country. There's no angst. There's no negative feelings that we're in the middle of nowhere and I'm with this Eritrean taxi driver. Everybody's cordial and kind, and it was quite an experience, eye-opening experience.
Yeah, as I'm listening to this, I'm like, I don't know what it says about me that I'm like, this is the most insane story I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. No problem.
That's awesome.
No problem. I drive you.
And we're going to eat a sandwich and you're going to get to your brewery and everyone's going to be happy because this is Sweden.
Exactly. And that's why when you see on the news, you know, that Scandinavian countries are the happiest people in the world, because everybody's cool and relaxed, and tax money goes for the betterment of the group. The tax money's going to pay for this young person that has special needs to be educated. I think it's just beautiful.
Yeah, that is awesome. And that's what a wonderful story for how, you know, this beer was coming to be. And I'm just taking a moment because I'm actually floored by that story. Yeah. That's awesome. That's really cool.
Maybe we should drink our Gotlandic beer here.
I think so.
Oh, I forgot to mention, unlike the traditional beers, which is dry hopped. Is dry hopped with German Polaris hops, so you can really taste the dry hop character in the beer.
You really can.
So you got juniper, you got sweet maltiness, you have smoke, although the smoke is really subsided.
Yeah,
and you taste that kind of aged dry hop character.
Yeah, and like I said, when this beer first came out, I absolutely fell in love with it. I love this beer because I'm just sort of this weirdo, right? I like a menagerie of Like, I think that's a menagerie, right? That's not easily definable. You know, it almost seems like the person who came up with it was sort of a Frankenstein. You know what
I mean? That's why you like 80s or 70s punk rock music.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And this beer to me is like just a great example of how you can take sort of divergent impulses and make something very, you know, beautiful and very unique out of it. And when it first came out, I remember reading the description of it and being like, I don't know how all this is going to work together, but then drinking it and being like, that's how all this is going to work.
Well, it could have certainly been a train wreck, but it's worked and it's certainly mellowed out. And it's
drinking really nice.
It's dessert in a glass.
Oh yeah. And the juniper and like the sort of the bitter of the juniper and the bitter of the dry hopping is still there, but you're right. The smoke has really sort of cooled out a bit. And that sort of sweetness on the back end really just pulls it all together. And as we're talking about beers that do better in the bottle, do you find with beers that have sort of these adjunct kind of characteristics, whether it's juniper or say a chocolate or a coffee built onto the base of like a beer that would naturally age well, that those sort of calm down or do they sort of amplify as it goes along?
Well, you know, that's a hard thing to answer. I would say that it can go either way in my experience. I've had brewed a peach beer that stayed peachy. I think we'll taste it at some point. It just kind of keeps giving.
Yeah. And that's the summer sour, which is also part of your beer library.
Yeah, exactly. But also, you know, it depends on the whole structure of the beer. It can be very, very complicated. Sometimes, like this smoke character in this beer has certainly diminished. Mm-hmm. Other types of flavors seem to have long legs. And I guess I can't really give you a rule of thumb for every flavor because it depends on the matrix of the beer.
Yeah. And that's, that's a good point you bring in about usually you can't really give a rule of thumb when it comes to aging beer. And as you start, and if you're listening to this and you start researching, what beers to cellar or how to go about doing that, you'll inevitably come across like the general rule of, you know, if it's a large stout that's highly alcoholic, it'll be good to age. Or if it's a sour, that's not necessarily higher alcoholic, but just a sour beer, it'll be good to age. But as in all things in life, within that sort of framework, there's just a million different sort of ways in beers that could fit in there for
different
reasons.
That's right. That's right.
Well, this has just been an awesome experience and an awesome sort of experiment in what beers do and don't do when you age them in the bottle. And, you know, and again, and as I stated at the top of this, due to the nature of how we record our podcasts, information of how Dan's beer library will be sort of getting out there in our beer depot is either forthcoming or already out there. And again, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where I'm sure that information will be shared widely. But the plan for now is to sort of take these beers that Dan has been collecting, over the last, I think the oldest one in the library is from maybe the Guza, the original vintage.
Yeah, that was 2014.
That was 2014. So, you know, almost 9 years now and sort of making these mixed 12 packs and having them silent auction style in the beer depot. Again, they would be put out in sort of batches and that information would be shared as to when you could come in and sort of bid on those. This is tied into our charitable giving endeavors that we've been doing at this brewery. Dan and Deb have been doing charitable giving basically since they could afford to do it with this brewery and through Only in Wisconsin Giving the last few years. So is there anything else you want to add about your beer library, Dan, or any plans for once this one is gone, starting up a new one? Or
oh yeah, well we have new RD beers coming for 2023, and I won't reveal those at this point, but we have two or maybe three more R&Ds that we will release.
And again, Dan, this has just been absolutely wonderful. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to have a nice afternoon drinking some beer with you.
Yeah, and we got two more to do, so we'll bang those out as soon as we can.
Sounds great to me.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, no problem.